Hey everyone, it's Marielle. And before we get to the show, I want to warn you. What you are about to hear contains explicit language, adult themes, and may not be suitable for all listeners. Discretion is strongly advised. Enjoy the show.
Alrighty, welcome to the Women of Death Row.
Hello, I'm Amanda.
I'm Marielle.
Thanks for listening.
I'm sleepy.
It's the wine.
I want to talk about a couple of things before we get to the real stories. First, I want to talk about Lamont McIntyre, the man who just had his conviction overturned after, I think, 23 years. Let me look it up really quick.
Yeah, it was definitely over 20 years. He spent on death row in, what state was it?
Kansas. Oh, this isn't the one. I wanted the one that was written by Amanda Jackson. Is it this one? Okay, so a Kansas man who was Lamont McIntyre awarded more than $1.5 million on Monday after spending 23 years in prison for a double murder that he did not commit.
So now the question is who did? But $1.5 million, come on. He deserves
$1.5 for each year.
Yeah.
Today, Lamont McIntyre has been declared finally and conclusively a completely innocent man, his attorney Cheryl Pilotti said in an emailed statement. That long overdue recognition, along with the statutory payment and other benefits, will help lighten a bit the heavy load he has carried. Lamont is grateful for the benefits of the compensation statute, but he knows his fight for justice is far from over. He was 17 in 1994 when he was arrested for double murder, even though no motive or physical evidence that tied him to the crime.
That's a story that's all too common.
Yeah, Kansas agreed to pay $1.1 million to Richard Jones of KCK, who spent 17 years in prison after being wrongfully convicted of a 2000 robbery. And then again to Floyd Bledsoe, spent 16 years behind bars for the rape and murder of a 14-year-old girl in Topeka, Kansas, a crime that his brother confessed to in a suicide note. Mm. And there's three other cases that remain pending.
Wow, three more and who knows how many else in other states.
Right. So, anyways, let's get to it.
Let's get to it.
I'm doing something a little different this week, kind of. Like, it's not a traditional death row. It is a woman who was executed, but not in the U.S.
Ew. Let's hear it.
All right. So, this is from capitalpunishmentuk.org. A 42-year-old Filipina maid was convicted by a Singaporean court of killing another Filipina maid, Delia Maga and Nicholas Huang, the 3-year-old Singaporean son of her employer, on May 4, 1991. She had originally confessed to the murders, but it was, however, claimed that she made the confession under duress. So she was hanged by Darshan Singh at 6 a.m. on Friday, the 17th of March, 1995, together with 3 male drug traffickers amid scenes of unusually tight security. 8 policemen, including 2 armed with machine guns and wearing flak jackets, stood outside the prison gates with 2 dogs. Police cars and motorcycles patrolled the street continuously, apparently to deter protests by the estimated 75,000 Filipinos who worked in Singapore. Anger swept the Philippines as the news of the execution broke. Leftist and feminist groups, human rights activists, and the media denounced Singapore as a barbaric, tyrannical, and totalitarian state with no respect for human rights. The Roman Catholic Church called Singapore a state without mercy.
Wow, that's harsh.
Mm-hmm. The execution caused a major diplomatic row between Singapore and the Philippines after Singapore rejected an appeal from the Philippines President Fidel Ramos. There were protests outside the Singapore embassy in Manila. Flor had said on the eve of her execution that she was ready to die after her final pleas for clemency and a new trial had been rejected. The Philippine Foreign Secretary said that she had thanked Filipinos for their efforts in trying to save her, but had said if the stay of the execution will only delay the carrying out of her sentence, she preferred to have an early end to everyone's suffering instead. Flor was visited in Chiang Mai prison daily by her children, a 21-year-old son, a 17-year-old daughter, and 15-year-old twin boys, who had last seen their mother in 1989. But her husband, Efren, didn't visit her. I could not bear to be able to see her and not be able to touch her or embrace her after 7 years. He made an emotional appeal a week earlier for help in saving his wife. She was informed of the date and the time of the hanging on Tuesday, March 14th, before the execution, as is customary in Singapore, and apparently took the news calmly. She was resigned to her fate, and she tried to be strong and told the children to be strong and love one another.
That's so sad.
The Philippine government had requested stay of execution in a letter to the Singapore government, asked to put all doubts to rest before the case of Mrs. Contemplacion comes to a final conclusion. He had urged Singapore to defer the hanging on humanitarian considerations. Philippine President Fidel Ramos had personally asked Singapore to postpone the execution until new evidence, testimony from another Filipino maid, had been evaluated. But the Singapore government said it carefully investigated this new evidence and found it to be untrue. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the Singaporean President Ong Teng Cheong found there was no basis to justify a stay of execution. At least two maids came forward during the week prior to the hanging to suggest that the little boy drowned during an epileptic fit in a bathtub and his father killed Mrs. Maga and flamed Flor. So she said in an affidavit that she'd shared a cell with Flor and had evidence of her innocence. In her affidavit, she said Della immediately phoned her employee about the incident. Her male employer immediately rushed home. Very angry, the employer strangled Della's neck. Then the employer called the police and implicated Flor in the double murder. A Singaporean Home Affairs Ministry statement said, "The wild and baseless allegations are yet another attempt to stir up controversy over the Flor Contemplacion case without any regard for the truth." So Flor Contemplacion's body was released and flown back to Manila and was greeted by the president's wife, Amelita, at the airport. Some mourners waved white handkerchiefs and others clenched their fists and carried placards saying justice for Flor Contemplacion. As her funeral passed through Manila's streets, people flocked around her house trying to catch a glimpse of her body and its open white coffin. Roman Catholic Bishop Teodoro Bacani held a requiem mass in the town's crowded cathedral for her. He told the congregation, "She is a symbol of millions of Filipinos driven by poverty to take their chances abroad. Their lot is pathetic. Their own government neglects them," he added, evoking applause from the congregation. So, President Ramos set up an inquiry into the case and ordered the exhumation of Delia Maga's remains to determine how she died. Her former husband complained that he and the family had never seen the autopsy report on her. Conrado Maga said his wife's body bore bruises on the shoulder, neck, and face. "We will try to determine if these are still present and if these could have been caused by a female," a Philippine detective, Maximo Reyes, said in a radio interview.
How do they plan to...
I mean, I think they mean, like, if she has had enough strength to do it. He said they may have to rely on bone findings since the remains have been buried for 4 years.
Jesus.
Doctors can tell in bone findings if there are any fractures or cracks. It's noteworthy that none of the, quote, new evidence that word to show her innocence came to light beforehand. In the last week of her life, everyone seemed to jump on the bandwagon, and yet she'd been in prison for 4 years and on death row for 2 of those years. There was little diplomatic activity during that time. No medical evidence was introduced either by the prosecution or the defense during the trial. In spite of bizarre symptoms experienced on the day of the murders, which she described in her confession. A witness said later that she had shared the same hospital with Contemplacion. The latter one day narrated how Nicholas Huang accidentally drowned and that Maga's employer was probably the one who killed her out of rage for his son's death. Mm. The witness also confirmed that Contemplacion related how she was tortured into accepting blame for Maga's death. On appeal, the case was sent back to the same trial judge to allow medical evidence to be heard. The defense then introduced medical evidence claiming that she had been suffering from a partial complex seizure at the time of the killings, while the prosecution's medical evidence maintained that she was only suffering from a mild migraine that day.
So they think that her migraine or seizure contributed to why she possibly killed someone. I haven't heard that before.
So 24 years later, now 25, various activists and family members gathered to call for an end of modern day slavery as they remembered the 24th death anniversary of Flor Contemplacion. Her tragic fate continues to reflect the plight of Filipino migrants, said Migrant Philippines chairperson Armand Hernando. The group lamented that abuse of overseas Filipino workers persists despite the passage of the Migrant Worker Act of 1995, which promised to prevent another case like Flores. She was hanged in Singapore on March 17, 1995. They expressed hope, so they say OFWs, which is overseas Filipino workers. The OFWs expressed hope that President Duterte will address the roots of forced migration like contractualization, landlessness, low wages, corruption, etc. 3 years on, many OFWs are still facing the same problems brought about by the government's labor
export program.
And a case that's just happened in February 2018. Joanna Demafelis returned to the Philippines in a wooden crate, welcomed by grieving family members who still couldn't believe that she'd been dead for nearly 2 years. Her corpse kept in a freezer in an abandoned apartment in Kuwait.
Good God.
The gruesome discovery of her remains sent shockwaves across the overseas OFW community and stoked outrage back home. President Rodrigo Duterte called her death a national shame and ordered a ban on the deployment of Filipino workers to Kuwait. 5 years earlier, in January 2013, Joanna had not even thought of leaving the country. She was 26, worked as a housekeeper for her relatives in Barañaque. She had enough money to send home to her parents in Sara, and she had the freedom to stroll around the country's largest malls. But in late 2013, a powerful storm swept across eastern Visayas, altered her plans. Super Typhoon Yolanda left over 6,000 people dead and $55 billion worth of infrastructure lost. Among those who suddenly found themselves homeless in the aftermath of Yolanda was the Demafelis family. The raging flood stripped down the family home to its frames and felled the old avocado tree that gave shade to the 9 Demafelis siblings when they were younger.
Oh, man.
So, since the storm destroyed their crops and the land could not be tilled, they had no other source of income, and so she
had to go work in Kuwait.
Yeah. 5 months after she talked to her aunt, Joanna finally hopped on a plane and headed to Kuwait. As demand rose for house help in Kuwait, many Filipinas flocked to the country. Tales of abuse followed. Filipinas fell to their deaths from apartment buildings for reasons still unknown.
God.
A domestic helper died after an illegally leashed lion pounced on her.
Jeez.
And I've seen a video of a migrant worker like being dangled from a balcony and the person just recording and laughing.
That's fucked up.
Yeah.
Don't ever do that.
In Kuwait, Philippine government offices at any given time sheltered hundreds of Filipinas pleading to go home after their daring escape from their abusive employers. Embassies report receiving thousands of complaints about confinement of domestic helpers in the house, months or years of unpaid wages, long work hours without rest, and verbal, physical, and sexual abuse. So the risk usually discouraged Joanna, but there were other things she found far more frightening, which was that they didn't have food to eat, and her parents would have worked for the rest of their lives trying to rebuild everything. Her younger siblings couldn't have an education, so she decided that it was just time. She needed to overcome her fears.
Essentially, she had to survive and provide for her family, mm-hmm. So it wasn't a choice for her.
For OFW rights groups, Migrant International, however, there's no need to look far to find incorrect policies that aided Joanna's death. When domestic helpers are alone, they're the persons they really confide information about their experience first are their relatives. Joanna's death prompted the governments of the Philippines and Kuwait to agree to fast-track a bilateral agreement that promises more protection for tens of thousands of OFWs in Kuwait. So on March 3rd, 2018, Joanna was laid to rest in her hometown. Hundreds attended her funeral mass, including Labor Secretary Silvestre Bello III. When she was laid to rest, the text on her tombstone read, "For if we live, we live to the Lord, and if we die, we die to the Lord."
Yeah, completely vulnerable people that, you know, everyone consumes the labor of migrant workers, but there's not enough, like, reporting for, like, ethical treatment of people. I'm going to share with you the story of Tiffany Cole and the robbery, kidnapping, and premeditated murder of Carol and Reggie Sumner. Tiffany Cole, along with 3 co-defendants, were convicted of the kidnapping and murder of Carol and Reggie Sumner. Tiffany Cole and the Sumners were really close. When the Sumners lived in a small town in South Carolina, the Cole family was their next door neighbor, or they lived like a couple houses down or something. The Sumners were known as a loving couple who had been together for a majority of their lives. It's actually interesting. They were together until they were about 17, and then Reggie joined the Air Force, and Carol had a baby with someone else. And after he left the Air Force, he went and worked for the railroad. And then she, unfortunately, lived a life of domestic violence from her ex-husband, and she left him after he shot at her a few times.
Fuck.
And then Reggie and Carol were reunited in their 50s and got married. They became particularly close with the Cole family, and they thought of Tiffany as like an additional grandchild, and they were delighted to support Tiffany financially in times of need. They knew Tiffany as this sweet young girl. She played the flute in school. She was a cheerleader and a Girl Scout. But after living in South Carolina for a few decades, the Sumners made a decision that is quite stereotypical of many older Americans. Can you take a guess? Yep, they moved to Florida for warmer weather and to live the rest of their years comfortably. So although the distance from like South Carolina and Florida, it's pretty significant, but I don't think it's wild. They stayed close with Tiffany in particular. They trusted Tiffany and they loved her, and she visited quite a bit. So while they were in Florida, Tiffany bought one of their cars and she would drive down to Florida to make the payments every month, and it was like a good excuse for her to visit. And from what I read about the Sumners, they probably cared more about the visit than they did the car payment.
Aww.
During one of those visits, Tiffany learned from the Sumners that they made a $90,000 profit from the sale of their house in South Carolina.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So in 2005, Tiffany started dating a guy named Michael Jackson. Not the Michael Jackson, though. And Michael would often join her on those trips to Florida to make the car payments and place visits to the Sumners. During one of those visits with Michael tagging along, Tiffany was like, hey, they made like $90,000 from the sale of their house. Like, probably just sharing about the couple, you know, what she knew about them, this new boyfriend. I think they had a lot of nice stuff in their home, too. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that conversation probably just came up naturally.
Mm-hmm.
So it was after that visit, with encouragement from Michael, that a plan to rob and drain the Sumners' bank account started. So Tiffany suggested that they use her relationship with the Sumners to manipulate their trust in her. And they also decided that they would need help. Are you falling asleep?
I'm tired, but I'm listening.
Okay. All right. So friends of Tiffany and Michael, Alan Wade and Bruce Nixon, they all collaborated to rob the Sumners of their belongings and their cash. However, the plan escalated when murder was introduced to the plan, but it doesn't really say who initially brought it up. So on July 8th, 2005, Tiffany, Michael, Alan, and Bruce drove to Florida to the Sumner house. Alan and Bruce went to the door and told the Sumners that they were in desperate need of a phone. Like, they were needed some help. And of course, the sweet, loving couple that wanted to help anyone they could invited them into the house to use the phone.
Shit.
But once they were inside, one of the dudes pulled a toy gun out and they viciously attacked the couple. They then bound and gagged Carol and Reggie, while Alan, Bruce, and Michael searched the Sumner house for valuables. After the beating and robbery, they were forced into the back of their own Lincoln Town car. Alan and Bruce drove the Lincoln, while Tiffany and Michael followed them in a Mazda that Tiffany rented for that trip. The plan was for Tiffany and Michael to intentionally get pulled over if police were to get too close to the Sumner's Lincoln. The caravan was driving across Florida state line to Georgia to a previously identified location with limited human activity. And just 2 days before the kidnapping, the whole group picked out a secluded area in Georgia and dug two large holes. When they all arrived at the spot on July 5th, the Sumners were forced to give up their bank account information and ATM card, especially their PIN. Then the Sumners were unfortunately buried alive.
What the fuck?
Yeah. The following day, the group returned to the Sumner house in Florida and attempted to clean the house with bleach to get rid of any evidence. They also stole jewelry and a computer, which Tiffany later pawned at a pawn shop. Over the next 2 days, the group celebrated this fucked up crime by spending thousands of dollars of the Sumner money. Tiffany and Michael rented a limousine and celebrated by drinking champagne and literally throwing money up in the air. Like, there's pictures.
Oh my God.
Yeah. On July 10th, 2005, so 2 days after the murder, I think I said July 5th, July 8th, so this is 2 days after the murder, Carol Sumner's daughter, Rhonda Alford, reported the couple missing. Investigators discovered a bank statement in the Sumner home that showed, like, a large sum of money, the deposit from their sale. Investigators contacted the bank and learned that an excessive amount of money from the Sumner's account had been withdrawn over the past couple days. On July 12th, Tiffany and Michael made a call to the sheriff's office posing as the Sumners. They told the detective that answered that they had to leave town early for an emergency and were having issues accessing accessing their bank account. So that detective, you know, he smelled BS and he contacted the bank himself and asked the bank to allow withdrawals to keep occurring so they could keep investigating and tracking everybody.
Oh, shit.
So the detectives were able to also track a cell phone, the cell phone that was used to call the sheriff's office, and learned that it belonged to Michael Jackson. Not the Michael Jackson. So the cell phone records showed that the cell phone was also used near the Sumner home at the time of their disappearance. Also, the cell phone record showed several calls to a rental car company, and the rental car company provided detectives a description of the Mazda, which was now overdue, and they gave them the information from the GPS showing that the Mazda was within blocks of the house of the night of the disappearance. So on July 14th, 2005, Michael, Allen, and Bruce were busted at a West Western in South Carolina. The police searched two hotel rooms that were reserved under Tiffany Cole's name. Police discovered personal property of the Sumners and their ATM card in the back of Michael's pocket. Tiffany was arrested at her home in South Carolina, and her address was obtained by the rental car company as well. Bruce Nixon was the first to confess to murdering the Sumners. He told police all the details of the crime, how it was planned, and where the Sumners were buried. So Tiffany testified during the trial. She testified that she unknowingly participated in a kidnapping murder plot and thought it would just be a robbery. She also testified that she was unaware the Sumners were in the trunk of the Lincoln and where they were going. Then she said the pre-drug holes were to be used to scare the Sumners into giving up their ATM card and PIN. So she's contradicting herself already. Yeah. And then the medical examiner showed the Sumners were indeed buried alive and their airways were blocked with dirt. And when they were discovered, they were able to unbind themselves, and they were found like holding each other. I know, it's heartbreaking. So on October 19th, 2007, Tiffany Cole was found guilty of two counts of murder on both premeditation and felony murder theories, two counts of kidnapping, and two counts of robbery. The jury deliberated for only 90 minutes. Tiffany was sentenced to death for each murder, life imprisonment for each kidnapping, and 15 years for each robbery.
Whoa.
Michael Jackson and Alan Wade were also sentenced to death. Bruce was sentenced to 45 years in prison. He pled guilty to second-degree murder and testified against his co-defendants. And he got that sentence because he made the confession. So Tiffany is currently on death row at the Lowell Correctional Institution Annex in Florida. She's the third youngest woman on death row in the country and is serving her sentence with Amelia Carr, who is the youngest woman on death row. I think she's like six stories back. In an interview with Diane Sawyer, along with Amelia Carr, Tiffany says she doesn't call death row, she calls it life row. By calling it death, you've already died. The Sumners are remembered as a loving couple who lived a hard life, but based on what we know about Tiffany as a kid, you know, it seems like she followed a crowd. She was in cheerleading, Girl Scouts. Her mom shared pictures of her at her trial when she was a kid, and I think that this genuinely shocked everybody. Her appeals and post-conviction relief was denied. She attempted to claim ineffective assistance of counsel, but she failed to show proof that a new trial was warranted. According to documents, the court documents and county documents, regardless, Cole could not demonstrate prejudice because there is no reasonable probability that the presentation of a more comprehensive duress defense would have created a different result at the guilt phase. So, that's Tiffany Cole. She and Amelia Carr are in the same prison on death row. So she's the third youngest woman in the country to be sentenced. I think she was 33 when she was sentenced. I know, all these young people.
Oh my goodness. Speaking of young people, Amanda Bynes has resurfaced on social media.
She's engaged, y'all, to her fiance Paul, who's drop dead gorgeous.
Is that how she said it?
Yeah, and she has a tattoos on her face, which, whatever, yeah, you do you. Amber Rose is rocking hers.
The heart is just not straight, though, is the only thing.
I think she did it herself.
Oh.
I would not be surprised if that was homemade.
Oh, yeah.
So last week, when I talked about Judy Buenaño, aka Goodyear, translate. So I was right about her being on death row with Carla Faye Tucker. It was the same time, just not same prison.
Oh,
so they served in the same time frame. Okay.
Gotcha, gotcha. I'm watching the trials of Gabriel Fernandez.
I heard now. That's sad.
Yeah, I'm going to have to probably restart it because the first episode I was like just dissociating and not checked out at certain points. But I'm really sleepy, so this is kind of a short one.
We're real lively tonight, y'all.
Man.
It's Friday night. Probably going to go to bed. I am finally watching Life with Bundy. Is that what it's called?
Calling for a Killer.
Falling for a Killer. So far, it's also difficult to watch. But I have been on another Bob's Burgers kick.
Me
I'll
too.
Just let it fucking run. Last night, I fell asleep on the couch at 9 o'clock and woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning. And it was still rolling.
Yep. And there's new episodes coming out.
That's amazing.
I just watched the latest one last night.
I recommended a coworker watch it with her kids. I told her it's not inappropriate, but it's geared towards adults. Like, there's a lot of things the kids won't get.
Yeah, the references.
It's not inappropriate at all.
Yeah.
So, what else? Oh, Good Girls.
The new season?
Excuse me. Oh my gosh, the new season of Good Girls is so good.
Oh shit, where are you watching it?
Hulu. So it airs on Sundays and you can watch it on Hulu starting at 4 a.m. It releases on Hulu at 4 a.m.
Okay.
So episode 3, this is the, we're going about to be on the 4th episode already.
Oh shit. Okay, I'm going to have to catch up.
I know. Anyways.
Yeah, that's all I got.
Oh, dispensaries will start opening up in Missouri May or June.
Cool.
So get your cards, y'all.
About damn time.
All right.
You've been listening
to the Women of Death Row. womenofdeathrowpodcast.com.
Everything's in the show notes.
Do people actually look at the show notes?
If they want to find us, that's where we tell them to go. Show notes.
Sometimes you got to give it to them, though. Just put it in Google and everything will pop up. All right.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.